Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The end of 2022 proved to be among the wettest on record across many spots in Northern California, and the new year did not disappoint. From Sierra snowpack to dangerous winds toppling trees, massive power outages across the valley, and flooding shutting down Highway 99, the first days of January are shaping up to be powerful weather-wise, with the potential for stronger atmospheric rivers and systems that are forecasted this week. While many of us were counting down the clock to 2023, Cap Radio was out covering the New Year's storm and its aftermath. Nick Miller is Cap Radio's managing editor of news and joins us with that bigger picture. Good morning, Nick.
Hey, Vicky.
Busy start of the year for you.
It was kind of terrifying.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all knew that there was going to be rain. Like, we knew that it was going to be kind of a wet and sloppy new year. But what do you think made this storm unexpected? I mean, it felt that way, at least to me.
Yeah, we knew there was going to be rain. We didn't expect this. And that's sort of because the atmospheric river that hit the Bay Area and the Sacramento Valley, it got kind of stuck. And it started building up on itself on New Year's Eve. And we all experienced that, right? The torrential downpour. And then afterward, the extreme winds that hit a high of 64 miles an hour at the airport, right? So that's why we see the downed trees. That's why we see the breaching of the levee in two areas on the Cosumnes River. That's why we see 99 closed and flooded. And it's now reopened. But there's, as you said, concerns because they're forecasting another. This is a bomb cyclone that's off the coast, but it could bring atmospheric river in that's much worse than what we experienced on New Year's Eve.
There were so many submerged cars along Highway 99 and flooding, and one person passed away. What can you tell us about what happened?
So they, on New Year's Eve, around 2-3 o'clock, they told residents of Wilton to evacuate. You know, so evacuation warning, get out. And then they realized it was too late, so they issued a shelter in place. But many people got stranded in the area, in the southeastern part of the county. Eventually, it flooded Highway 99 between Elk Grove and Galt in that area, and it remained closed most of New Year's Eve evening and on New Year's Day. And I mean, it's just an astonishing level of precipitation that was in part caused by the warmness of the storm, and we saw a lot of upstream, you know, like rivers running downstream and filling everything up really quickly.
I was up in the foothills for the new year, and when we came back down to the city, to Sacramento, I mean, and in many cases, it still looks like this. There are trees on the road. There's a lot of debris that's still around streets in downtown Sacramento, as well as power outages. Where do those power outages stand as of today?
That's right. We're still recovering from the New Year's weekend storm. There's about 2,000 SMUD customers still without power. That's mostly City of Sacramento folks. There are still warnings for flash flooding. That's moving more into the Delta, but still parts of South Sacramento, Southern County, Sacramento. You drive all over town and there's trees everywhere that still haven't been cleared up or broken down, you know, whether you're in Land Park or the Central City or whether you're in some of the, you know, the farther reaches of Sacramento County. We're still recovering from this storm. And the big concern is there's a new storm coming in. You know, I spoke with Brian Ferguson. He's deputy director of crisis communications for the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services. And I think we're going to hear a few of some of the things they're doing to prepare.
The event that may be most similar to what we're experiencing now was spring of 2017, where we had the incident with the Oroville Dam, which is when we exited the last drought. And so this sort of cycle is not unique in California, but it doesn't make it any less challenging. And so, you know, trying to learn from those past experiences and be a little bit better and hopefully keep people safe when the weather changes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I was at the spillway in Oroville back in 2017 and with the reconstruction. And it's truly humbling seeing the power of water from that experience.
Well, this is concerning to have the analogy be 2017 and the Oroville spillway when the dam was damaged.
And the mass evacuation of nearly 200,000 residents downstream.
Yeah. So that's sort of the scenario we're dealing with this week. And with, again, on the horizon, we have two or three atmospheric rivers forecasted to hit Northern California over the next 10 days. This is something every resident needs to be very concerned about and be preparing for.
So how is the state's Office of Emergency Services, as well as other emergency crews, how are they preparing for this?
Oh, it's all hands on deck. Everything from making sure they have rescue crews positioned in areas that could flood, and they may need to rescue people who get trapped in vehicles, to working with local agencies, to monitoring reservoirs about how they're going to release water, if they're going to need to release water. And I spoke to Brian a little bit more about this.
So as we look ahead to the rest of the week, our thought is to always plan ahead and be ready, whether that's locally or at a statewide level. And so communicating with the local first responders, ensuring that they have appropriate plans in place. They have supplies, whether that's things like sandbags, equipment to let the public know the roads are closed. And so continue to do that advanced planning so we don't get caught by surprise.
Yeah. And that also includes our newsroom. You're the managing editor of news. How is CAP Radio preparing in terms of the coverage for the week and the aftermath and potentially the days ahead?
Well, we do a variety of things. We are obviously there with the most essential information to keep you safe in preparation, in the moment, and in afterwards. But we also have subject matter experts who are explaining, why, through a climate change lens, why we're experiencing more extreme weather like this. Through a racial equity lens, which communities are more adversely affected by it. And that's sort of the work that our team is doing. So whether you're on capradio.org or listening on the air, you're going to be getting information all day long, and then different types of information, more context, more depth, more understanding.
How do you want listeners to think of this week and in terms of the weather?
Think about keeping yourself, your families, and your friends safe. We are in for something that some of us may not have experienced ever, if not for many decades. This is an extreme, serious, powerful, and dangerous storm, and we all need to prepare.
Nick Miller, thanks so much.
Thanks, Vicki.
Nick Miller is CAP Radio's managing editor of news. Up next, we'll learn about how California is making it easier for street medicine teams to respond to people experiencing homelessness by providing medical care directly to encampments across the state. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Navigating healthcare is just complicated, from establishing primary care to being connected to specialists, understanding coverage and how much services can cost. The healthcare system is far from user-friendly. And as California's record unhoused population continues to grow, so does a homelessness health crisis that strains emergency rooms as well as our moral compass. Because preventative care isn't realistic for a vulnerable population that faces economic and logistical barriers to accessing a traditional brick-and-mortar doctor's office or clinic. Street medicine has been around for decades. It was created in the early 1990s as a tool to directly offer medical care to those living on the streets. But this has long been a grassroots response to homelessness, which means consistent funding can be a big challenge. However, late last year, California's Medi-Cal agency, which serves low-income residents, announced a big change so that street medicine can fit into traditional health care. There currently are 25 street medicine teams across the state. I spoke with CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf and Kristen Wang, who covers health policy for CalMatters, for a statewide look into how street medicine works from rural to urban cities. We're going to get a statewide look, but let's start in Sacramento. Kate, how did you come to learn of street medicine?
So, Vicki, I arrived at CAP Radio this fall from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, where I covered housing and homelessness issues. And when I was out in encampments covering those issues, I met a lot of people who were dealing with chronic illness and a lot of people who just didn't know where to get access to medicine, didn't know how to treat any ailments. So when I started as the new healthcare reporter here at CAP Radio, I really wanted to figure out what efforts are being done to help people access medical care, and what does that look like?
So, and in turn, you shadowed a street medicine team in the capital city, and you really got this firsthand look at how they provide medical care. Walk us through, help us visualize how they actually do their job.
Definitely. I reached out to Anthony, or Tony Minacho, who's a physician's assistant. He's a family medicine PA and a street medicine PA. And he started the group Sacramento Street Medicine about 3 years ago. And he studied under Brett Feldman, who I know we'll talk about later, a real huge force in the street medicine space. So I met up with Tony and his team in mid-December, and they were a group of about 10 people, mostly student volunteers, who were there to do both outreach and medical care. And we met in the parking lot of a Chevy's right by an encampment called The Island, which is near Discovery Park. It's right by the American River. And there was an outreach team who was providing hand warmers, food, water, sort of basic survival needs. And there was a medical team of about three or four people who were there to meet up with a list of patients and really help them with whatever they needed. And whether that be dealing with a pretty severe dog bite or testing for diabetes and providing an HIV test kit. So a lot of their work is also characterized as soft touch. So it's just checking in with people about how things are going. Tony characterized their work in this way.
The solution to homelessness is a home, right? So the goal is to eventually bridge to that. But, you know, if we can play a small part in providing medical care and taking care of their physical and psychological needs just by being here, then we do so.
So they go to the island every other week, and with about five other camps that they dispatch to in the Sacramento area. And they're really just there to build trust and make sure people know that they're available for medical help.
And these solutions, this type of solution, this tool has been taking shape over recent years. I remember back in 2017 when I worked at KCRA here in Sacramento, I actually followed a street medicine nurse in downtown. And that was funded by Sutter Health and WellSpace Health. But it was like a lone nurse canvassing downtown, providing free medical care to those experiencing homelessness. It was pretty novel at that time. It was about 5 years ago. Also very grassroots. How did these street medicine teams differ from back then?
I think the main difference is that they've tried to make it so that they have a prescriber, someone who is a physician, who's able to right then and there provide medication, provide lab, do lab work, you know, or do a blood test, you know, are there to make sure that all of the care that's possible, that's needed, can be done right there on the street.
Any idea how long this has been around?
I think it's hard to pinpoint. My research has shown that this has been a thing on the East Coast since about the 90s, sort of a formalized thing, but it has evolved hugely in the past few decades. Brett Feldman, who's a physician assistant at the USC Keck School of Medicine, he explained it in this way.
And then when street medicine started, we thought of ourselves as transitional primary care, where we were to provide a certain, you know, lower level of primary care on the street with the ultimate goal of transitioning them to brick and mortar clinic. And the longer that we did it, we realized that as long as they were on the street, that aspiration to transition them just wasn't realistic. So we've spent the last decade or so really increasing the level of care that we can provide on the street to make it equal to what you would get in a brick and mortar clinic.
Right, like meeting people where they are in realistic conditions. I guess what led to this type of care?
I think the impetus for starting these teams has been physicians' desire to be helping to the greatest extent. Brett Feldman really describes it as a moral wound to not be taking care of these people.
It's always cheaper to not provide care or not provide services. At least it seems cheaper up front. But the cost is also known, and it's really the cost of our humanity and the cost of civilization.
Brett has also talked about the mixed feelings of seeing the care model, the street medicine model, blow up, you know, really become more and more of a policy driver, because he knows that this has happened in large part because more and more people are experiencing homelessness, are being priced out of housing in California and are struggling on the streets.
Yeah, we have a record number of those experiencing homelessness. And when we get these point in time counts every couple of years, they're always, you know, cautioned to be an underestimate, but it is growing and it's a record number. When it comes to how those experiencing homelessness or don't even have stable housing, how they receive medical care. I mean, we're talking about a cost, you know, to our morality, but also there is a financial cost, right, to the hospital system that makes it unsustainable.
Definitely. I think that because unhoused folks don't have access to preventative care, they don't know how to get to a space where they can get something that they're concerned about treated, they end up going to emergency rooms, they end up getting treated, or they end up dying.
When you actually spoke with people who are experiencing homelessness in Sacramento about their health, what stands out to you about the barriers and the unique challenges that they face?
Right. I think there's a slew of things that maybe people don't really think about in terms of how unhoused people get access to care. I think, people are preoccupied with basic survival, where to sleep, how to get food, water, where to use the bathroom, really simple things that people take for granted. And also people's planning horizons can be really limited. So if even if you get a doctor's appointment for next week, sometimes you can't plan out that far, you know, and so so it becomes where you're only thinking about the next few days and hours. I think one of the biggest things is that people feel that they can't leave their belongings. They can't leave their livelihoods, which are in, a tent or where they've been staying. So I spoke with Omi Williams, who had visited a warming center in December. She's 36, and she shared with me that she's transgender and she took hormones for many years. But because of her lifestyle, she can't take those with regularity. She also has asthma and GERD, which she says are really poorly managed, unfortunately, because she just can't keep a hold of things.
I can't carry much, and everything that we have to survive on. It's terrible, when we can't pack things around in carts or we get ran away with from security from this place to that place to the next. And there's just no solution, really.
So at the moment, Omi's long-term health just can't be her top priority.
Kristen, I want to bring you in because your reporting on street medicine teams really took you all over the state. I mean, you were in urban centers like Los Angeles. You went up to rural communities in Shasta County, also the Central Valley. I mean, the crisis of homelessness, as we know, touches every corner of the state. How many of these teams do you think there are statewide?
There are at least 24 teams operating statewide, and they've been pretty sort of small and limited in their scope. They do a ton of great work, but as you said, homelessness is such a huge crisis, and 24 teams is not that many, relatively speaking.
Let's start up north in Shasta County. You got a look at how street medicine works in Redding. What did you learn from them?
I think the thing that struck me the most when I was up in Redding with the Shasta Community Health Center's HOPE team was what a deep relationship the providers had with the patients that they were treating on the street. I spent several days with them, and we could hardly drive 2 or 3 blocks down the street without the doctor pulling over, rolling down the window, waving at somebody, greeting them by name. And then, later he knew their medical history and details. And so it was really apparent to me how deep the trust ran with that team and the community.
And because there was that trust, they're willing to be vulnerable and open up. You followed Dr. Kyle Patton, who's the medical director of the street medicine program at Shasta Community Health Center. And he talked about the barriers that this population faces because these people open up to him. So let's listen to part of what he explained to you.
When you're focused on those very basic needs like food, safety, shelter, how are you then able to focus on, managing your diabetes or your blood pressure or some of these risk factors that can lead to more serious downstream effects? People staying outside, they're also at greater risk for trauma, assaults, just some of those more exposure related conditions can, I think, plays into some of that mortality risk. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Kate touched upon that when shadowing a team in Sacramento, there could be dog bites or other injuries of that nature. And you met a woman in Redding with Dr. Patton, whose name was Amber Schmidt, who needed medical care. And I think Amber really encapsulates those barriers that those without stable housing can often face. Tell us about her situation.
Yeah, Amber was a woman who is from the Northern California area. I think she grew up in Davis, actually, and throughout her life has had some really serious health events, including being a lymphoma survivor. And it sort of like precipitates, you know, these catastrophic health events very, very frequently precipitate poverty, extreme poverty and homelessness. And so she's been living in Reading for several years, but it is really difficult to live on the streets. When I met her with Dr. Patton, she had a pretty gnarly looking infection and gash on her leg that Dr. Patton had actually cleaned and bandaged for her before. But, you know, the realities of living on the street was that she ran out of bandages eventually. You know, you run out of your prescription. She was reusing bandages, so it became infected again.
Yeah. Dr. Patton also talked to you about how substance abuse, that's another component, can be better treated with street medicine teams because it's about building those relationships and building that trust. So let's take a listen to what he told you.
People that are unsheltered living on the street, people that use substances or IV drug users, like these pockets we haven't been able to reach. And that's not because they don't want that treatment. I think it's because of limitations in how we're delivering healthcare. So that's kind of a good example, right? Like my patients would be open to these treatments, but we have to adapt some of our processes.
Yeah, I mean, what he's saying is creating some reliability to those who live in unreliable situations day in and day out, Kristen.
Yeah, keeping promises and being consistent was so crucial to the philosophy of Dr. Patton and Brett Feldman, who Kate mentioned earlier. It's really about, you know, recognizing everybody's humanity and that they still have, in a life situation where they're in, where they feel like they have so little agency and choices, giving them the access to healthcare to make choices about their health, whether that be, you know, substance use treatment or other things. So it was, you know, that was one of the things that really, really stood out to me was that they really put the person first and the medical care and the treatment is not about forcing anybody into anything, but about giving them those options.
Yeah, well, let's get to the biggest one in California, which is in Los Angeles. And you were with Dr. Feldman along Skid Row. I'm an Angeleno, so I'm very familiar with that area in downtown. But for those who aren't familiar with it, can you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, Skid Row is, I think, very unfortunately notorious across the country for sort of what it represents for the homelessness crisis. It's a very densely populated, I think officially about 5-block area of Los Angeles, although certainly in recent years it has expanded beyond that. But very densely populated, just tents up and down the streets. It can be a pretty chaotic environment. I think people there are also, you know, used to sort of being taken advantage of, with, you know, people, you know, with cameras, like it's kind of a spectacle. So people are also pretty wary and skeptical of when others come into their area.
And while in LA, you shared the story of Danny Duran, who has been on the streets for a couple of years. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Danny was a patient, an older gentleman in his 50s, who I met actually with the Los Angeles County has a new street medicine team that they started during the pandemic. And he was somebody who he had a career and, you know, a loving family. And he was a plumber, a pipe fitter. And his wife died several years ago. So he was living alone when he went into a diabetic coma, was hospitalized for a very long time. And then while he was hospitalized, he trusted a friend to pay his mortgage, pay his bills, and that friend sort of emptied his bank account and ran. And so that was the event that precipitated his homelessness. And so he was living in Whittier Narrows Park when I met him. And he's diabetic, but he has no regular access to insulin. So he was super unsteady, super shaky, super woozy. The team there helped him. They also gave him a plate of food, and I kind of, you know, let him feel a little bit better for about 30 minutes before I talked to him. But his story was really revealing about like how difficult it is, how health can precipitate homelessness, and then once you're on the streets, things just get worse.
Let's listen to a part of what Danny told you.
I went straight to work the day after I turned 17, full-time. I had a career, and I was an excellent plumber and pipe fitter. I handled my customers with compassion and treated them like human beings. And I had a career, and then everything sort of hit the skids with this accident. And it's just like snowballed everything bad. And
yeah.
I'm ready for a little bit of good.
When you typically need some sort of medical care, where do you go?
The emergency room to get my medication. And it's such a cost to the insurance company, I'm sure, to have me go to the emergency room. But my primary care doctor, she does no longer take people like myself with Medicare, Medi-Cal. And so I guess she don't have to anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Kristen, what Danny told you is so personal to him, but the challenges he faces getting out of poverty and navigating health care is not.
Yeah, I mean, Danny really touched on a lot of different systematic challenges there, one being people not taking Medi-Cal as insurance, which is, you know, increasing because of the low reimbursement rates. And then there's also the expense to the system, which you and Kate touched on a little bit earlier, that, you know, when you don't have a primary care doctor and you don't have regular access to address chronic conditions, your last resort is the emergency room. And that is, A, not good for the patient, because it's not, you know, the ER is set up to get people in and out as quick as possible, because you never know when a more critical emergencies coming down the line. So it's not a good place to address chronic health concerns. And then it is also incredibly expensive. If you've ever been to the ER and gotten a bill, you know, it's thousands of dollars, versus if you need something as routine as insulin, which is also expensive on its own, but you know, right, that visit to the primary care doctor, that prescription is a much lower cost than, you know, it's hundreds of dollars versus thousands of dollars.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf, as well as Kristen Wang, a health policy reporter for CalMatters, about street medicine teams across the state are tackling a homeless healthcare crisis. Kristen, you mentioned there's a couple dozen of these teams across the state. How is this funded?
Historically, these have been funded primarily as sort of philanthropic charity organizations. Either a philanthropy is fully funding them, or a health system might, you know, see the need and fund a team to do street medicine. But it's been, you know, it's kind of a losing, in terms of money, a losing game. But that's changing already.
Right. And Danny touched upon the challenges with Medi-Cal, but there are some changes to Medi-Cal, which is making it more possible to support street medicine, right? How is that working?
Yeah. So at the beginning of this year, the state Medi-Cal agency launched this big sort of multi-year, very broad ranging transformation of the Medi-Cal system called CalAIM. And one piece of CalAIM was requiring Medi-Cal insurers to take on the burden of like organizing and navigating and coordinating the systems of care between like your doctor and your psychiatrist and social services. Usually those people never talk to each other and they don't know what's going on. And, you know, navigating all of that as a patient in general can be very frustrating and very difficult. And if you have the added challenges of living on the streets and just having to survive, it becomes impossible. So part of this change to Medi-Cal has been requiring insurers to take that burden off of the patient and do that really intensive case management themselves to hopefully improve outcomes. And along with that is money. which is very promising for street medicine teams, both in terms of their sustainability for the existing ones and then expansion into areas of the state where these teams don't yet exist.
Kate, when you were following the street medicine team in Sacramento, did they share kind of any concerns about funding and scaling up and ultimately this being sustainable while keeping the core intention of this?
Yeah, I think what my experience was, I know Kristen mentioned that this is actually kind of a time of hope for a lot of street medicine teams. And that's definitely what I heard from both Brett and Anthony, especially because there are now incentives for health insurers, health plans to be teaming up with street medicine teams. So there's a lot of money in actually, you know, making connections and enabling street medicine teams to do more comprehensive work in their tradition way of doing it, which is very patient centered, very patient powered. And I do think that, you know, the Sacramento street medicine, it has so many people wanting to volunteer for it. It has so many students wanting to get involved that it's even closing applications. It's turning people away. I mean, there are hundreds of people who are trying to get involved with that space. So I do think there's a lot of people, a lot of medical students who see the need, who see the want, who want to get involved.
The will is there.
The will is totally there. And so I think that, you know, I definitely heard that it was a time of hope for them.
Yeah. One other thing I would add, though, is that even though this is a time of hope and the state Medi-Cal agency has been making a lot of changes to incentivize payments for this work, there is still a gap between the total services that are being provided and what they can get reimbursed for. Actually, Dr. Patton up in Shasta County, he had this great quote for me. He uses a swear word, so I won't say it on air, but I'll paraphrase. But he says that he spends about 70% of his time just chatting with patients and only 30% of the time providing actual medical care. But that 70% of the time is sometimes more critical than the 30%, because in building that trust, people, you know, they come up to you later and say, hey, I'm having this problem, when they might not trust you otherwise. Or they'll also tell him, like, hey, you know, a woman a few tents down is pregnant and she probably needs some help. But it's sort of like the human interaction that you can't bill for, that our medical system in general is not set up to bill for.
Finally, for both of you as reporters shadowing street teams across the state, how did it deepen your understanding of the health challenges facing those experiencing homelessness or even stable housing? Kristen?
I think one of the things that I took away very personally was that sort of any one of us could be one or three sort of health crises away from just very life-altering circumstances. And just because somebody's life has, you know, taken a turn into extreme poverty and homelessness doesn't mean that their health care should stop. That was kind of a lasting sort of personal impact for me. And the other thing, too, was just that a lot of these sort of social safety nets that we have set up for people don't take into account, like, they were not built necessarily with their input. So this isn't a Medi-Cal example, but Medi-Cal will pay for transportation to get to and from a doctor's office. But in order to use that benefit, you have to have a fixed address and you have to give the insurer like several weeks notice.
Yeah, which is not realistic.
It's just not realistic if you're living on the streets. So there are a lot of little changes to our system, I think, that need to be made to really be able to help people.
How about you, Kate?
I think something that, you know, I knew that housing is healthcare, and I just, you know, really saw that in action where, you know, if you don't have a home, your healthcare is just going to be, you know, buffeted time and time again. And I also, something that really stuck out to me is how crucial these teams are to helping people get housed, because something that Brett shared with me is you know, people are more likely to want to, you know, communicate and interact with someone who is there to help them about a wound that they're concerned about than they are necessarily to give all their information to someone from the county with a clipboard who maybe isn't going to come back for another 6 months, can't promise them anything, can't guarantee them anything. So it's important for those teams to work together with people who are trying to provide housing for unhoused people, because they are the ones that are keeping that relationship going, and they're the ones who are ultimately, you know, points of contact that can help the county find where those people, you know, keep track of those people and make sure that, you know, they're all working together to get them help. So that was a big takeaway for me.
Kate and Kristen, thanks for joining us and sharing both of your reportings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter Kate Wolf and Kristen Wang, who covers health policy for CalMatters, giving us a statewide look at how street medicine teams are being used as a tool in response to a growing health crisis for those experiencing homelessness. Still ahead, new year, new improved you. We'll talk about the psychology behind intentions and resolutions with a psychiatrist who researches stress and wellness and learn what's really effective for both body and mind. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Gym memberships, dry January, cutting back on spending, perhaps achieving the ever-elusive work-life balance, and a wide array of intention lists to create a better year for mind and body. The tradition of resolutions is back because it can feel like we lose ourselves a little bit by the end of the year. We get overwhelmed, we get caught up, which are the perfect ingredients for stress, and then we feel depleted as we reflect on what we want to achieve for the new year. But at the core of this annual goal setting is the desire to improve our health, whether it's physical, mental, financial, or spiritual. And well-being is certainly within our reach. Dr. Elisa Epple is a professor at the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at UCSF and a New York Times bestselling author with a new book for the new year, The Stress Prescription. Dr. Epple joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicky. So happy to be here.
You know, resolutions are kind of cyclical, or they are cyclical from one year to the next. Where do resolutions and these intentions stem from?
It's so natural to want to demarcate time, to want to step back and say, you know, that was then, what's new, and looking ahead. So it's a really healthy tradition. We've kind of divided our life up into before and after the holidays, and 2023, I'll do this or that. And that is, it's wonderful for us to really reflect. We have so little time to reflect on how we live each day. The problem is that those resolutions that you were stating, the goal to be more fit, to lose weight, first of all, we recycle them year after year. And second of all, we drop them after a few weeks or months. 90% of people don't reach their goal by the end of the year. So we need to rethink what we're telling ourselves we should do and choose goals that are much more achievable and impact everything in our life. And you can guess, as you stated, I'm going to urge people to think about their emotional well-being.
Yeah, I mean, we lead with our best foot forward for the new year, and we want them to be effective. But, you know, they do have the potential time and time again, year and year again, of being maybe counterproductive or discouraging or even harmful. And when talking about wellness, you're also the director at the Aging, Metabolism, and Emotion Center at UCSF. When and why was the center created?
That's a good question. Somewhere in the, you know, 22 years of my being there, early on, we realized that we needed to bring these words together because we are so interconnected. Our emotions, our body's regulatory systems, including our metabolism. And so this is how we age. We partly control how we age with our emotional well-being, where acute stress is something we can work well with, our body loves it, and chronic stress can be toxic and accelerate our biological aging.
How has chronic stress for us collectively as a society changed over the years?
It has gone up, and there are many studies documenting increases in the levels of stress people feel, as well as the number of stressful events they report experiencing each day. So it's real. This was increasing already before the pandemic. And of course, things have intensified a lot. We have 120 million new cases of depression and anxiety since 2020. Now, while it's increased, we also have a different type of chronic stress that we're dealing with. We still have our personal challenges, and we also now are so deeply in touch with the suffering of the world. We see the stresses, the strains, the traumas of people across the world. We see it visually, we see it daily. We have front row seats to the most upsetting things happening in the world. So we are dealing with existential stress as well, and that can really darken our view of humanity and of our life, especially for our young people and our young adults.
Yeah, that front row seat is available on any screen that we have on our disposal, especially when it comes to our cell phones. You literally look under the microscope and you look at how this type of stress, chronic stress, can actually affect our cells in terms of aging and health. What did you learn about that?
The field has been moving toward more sophisticated measures of how we can examine aging even in a young person. We can look at all the mechanisms of aging in our blood, in our cells, and whether we're looking at telomeres, mitochondria, inflammation, or epigenetics, they tell us a similar story, which is that our lifestyle is very much tied in with our rate of aging, and so is our chronic stress. And so chronic stress and traumatic stress at an early age are both related to accelerated cellular aging, lower mitochondrial enzymes, shorter telomeres, greater inflammation.
There is also such a thing as positive stress, which I found surprising when reading a little bit of your book that was just released. Can you explain what positive stress is and why stress is a part of our lives?
We definitely think of stress as one monolithic thing, and it's much more complex than that. When we look under the hood, there are different types of stress. And a lot of the daily stress that we deal with is good stress, is engagement stress, when we're trying to achieve things that we care about. And we can use that acute stress response to energize us and cope better. And then it's important for us to step out of our own way and recover quickly and not sit there and ruminate or stew, but really burn up the energy that we've mobilized, often with a walk or push-ups or something physical. That's one way to deal with metabolizing stress in our body. But there's another way, which is just intentionally giving ourselves these kind of short shots of stress. And the most typical example is high intensity interval training or bursts of aerobic exercise. And that it turns out to be great for fitness. We knew that, but great for stress fitness, reduces anxiety, rumination, as well as the metabolic health benefits.
And that brings me to your new book, The Stress Prescription. I mean, how did this book come about, and what do you hope readers take away from this book?
The Stress Prescription includes very solid foundational ways that we can nudge ourselves to reduce the kind of chronic lurking stress, uncertainty stress, the stress of things we can't control, as well as to focus our attention on the things that we really care about and how we want to spend our time, things that are beautiful and right in front of us, like nature, relationships, people we love. So there are shifts that we can make, both focusing on joy as well as identifying and releasing this pervasive chronic stress that we may be holding in our body. So it gives people some free, easy, short nudges or practices, and people can really just go to the chapter that they know will mean the most to them. It's not a book that you have to read through and try everything. It's more about what can you incorporate in a regular way because it's our how we live our day, and those small nudges or changes that we can make that add up over time and really become how we live our life.
Right, because sometimes we might think it's like, oh, I have to take a week or two off and go to a retreat, but that's not always realistic for people. What are some manageable things that we can do on a daily basis, maybe in the span of 10 to 15 minutes, that is truly restorative for us and allows us to kind of to relieve that stress or give our bodies and minds a break from stress?
Mm-hmm. So starting with how we wake up, we can set our trajectory. It's so common to wake up with a lot of stress energy, especially if we've packed our day. And so just even taking a few minutes to reset our trajectory, focus on something that we're looking forward to, and do something for our body to settle our mind. That might be yoga, that might be slow breathing, even for just a few minutes. And if you've looked at your phone, and you've seen your to-do list or emails coming in, it's not too late to then put it down and take a few minutes to ourselves. These short breaks are so important, both at the bookends of our day, waking and bedtime, but also during the day. They help regulate and ground us so that we can be our best selves and not see the world through this kind of filter of threat and rush and just going through our checklist without really experiencing life more deeply.
Yeah, when thinking of that rush for myself personally, for me, it really hits me when I'm trying to unwind and go to sleep and trying to relax. But, you know, I start worrying about things and that keeps me awake. It's really difficult to kind of decompress and get that rest that you need. What recommendations do you have to get sleep, which is truly important for your health in so many ways, and many of us don't get really good quality sleep.
Mm-hmm. The wind down before sleep is so important. As my colleague Eric Prather, a sleep scientist, says, we treat our brain like it's a computer, and we think we can just shut down the laptop and go to sleep. But in reality, there are many things we can do to wind down and allow our mind to release all of the accumulated stress of the day, the unconscious stress that we're carrying. And so having a time before bedtime where we don't have screens and we agree not to talk about stressful situations with those we live with, having that regular ritual is so important. So making the to-do list before bed, having some worry time, setting aside 5 or 10 minutes to write out what you're worried about. Sure, there's the to-do list, but there's always what's lurking underneath our vigilant stress response that we can identify, name, and write down. And so kind of getting all the worries out within a short worry window is helpful for people who are on, let's just say, high anxiety mode.
Yeah.
And as an example, Vicky, I was looking, so I woke up today. I did a few things in my book. I don't always do that. So I woke up with just so much jittery stress energy, and my day was just overscheduled. It's something I can control, but I have it just absolutely packed in. And we just kind of rule out the possibility of having a balanced day and a day where we're able to come down from our stress high between things when we pack things back to back. So that's, you know, that's something that seems easy, but we often, you know, view time as the most important commodity instead of how we're interacting with time, our body's wellness. So anyway, I did take a reset. I looked forward to talking to you, Vicky, and a few other things that were more personal. And then I just had so much extra glucose mobilized for today. And I did a bike, you know, like a 8-minute intense aerobic thing. And that was probably one of the only ways I could have burned off all that extra energy today.
Well, it was a pleasure talking with you, Dr. Eppel.
It was wonderful to talk with you, Vicky. Thank you so much.
Dr. Elisa Epel is the Vice Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, as well as the Director of Aging, Metabolism, and Emotion Center at UC San Francisco. Also author of the new book, The Stress Prescription, 7 Days to More Joy and Ease. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.